introduce Wendy Thompson is on the screen. So I'll let you read that, and welcome Wendy Thompson. She's a program co-chair, which I don't think is there.
I'm afraid you're going to have to bear with me because my voice hasn't improved since last night, when some of you will have already noticed it wasn't working too well. I'll see how it goes. Can people hear me? Yeah? Okay. Well, there's so many ways one can try and respond to the challenge of this sort of an event. And the way I'm going to respond to it is by really giving you my kind of received wisdoms based on my sort of, you know, what I hope would be practice-based evidence of many years, a little bit of evidence-based practice, but probably more the other way around, and probably make some wild assertions that either will meet with your complete agreement or opposition. So we'll see. But I've gone to the high end of the helicopter rather than the detail, so there'll be a lot of things that could be challenged in a lot more forensic, but I thought it would be good to give some overview of where I think we are at with social policy. So I thought this was a quote worth mentioning. I feel like everybody here is interested in social policy, but there aren't that many real social policy people. So I feel a responsibility to uphold the tradition. And this is, it's not always been a proud one, but it is one, and it's one that I'm part of. So this is a quote from someone who is a sort of predecessor of much social administration in the Western world, Richard Titmuss. And if you read it, I thought it was pretty appropriate to the kind of thinking that we're now pretty much immersed in. You know, social policy is all about social purpose and the choices between them. These choices and the conflicts between them have continuously to be made at the governmental level, the community level, and the individual level. And at each level, by acting or not acting, voting or not voting, opting in or contracting out, we can influence the direction of which choices are made. This was written in early 1950s, which I thought, given, you know, how statist and national government-ish we got after that, was interesting. Thank you. But I also thought we should think this not just a British tradition, although I think Titmuss represents some of the best of the British tradition of social policy. Here in McGill, we really ought to mention that we had the founder of the New Democratic Party, the best that we have as far as an electorally serious left party in this country, was founded by somebody called J.S. Woodsworth, who founded first the CCF, which later became the NDP. But the most important thing to know about this man is that he was the uncle of David Woodsworth, who was the director of the School of Social Work at McGill when I was there. So, you know, this is a tradition that has a Canadian perspective on it as well as an international and British one. Anyway, so this is going to be a broad sweep of history, and, you know, some of you will recognize it, maybe some of you won't, and maybe we'll have time for a discussion about that. I think in the recent past, social policy has been in a bit of a depression, really, since the oil crisis, really, of the later 1970s. You know, a lot of social policies have been seen as fiscally unaffordable, politically not very easily supported. And really, if you got an intellectual argument, it often was with the hollowing out of the nation state. You know, the relevance of national-level social policies became of decreasing importance. And you can, you know, in Canada, this takes its particular bottom point probably with when in the social policy world, maybe not for the rest of the world, but in the mid-90s when the zero budget was finally adopted at federal level, and many of the major national benefit programs like unemployment insurance, etc., were cut. But so were some other major transfer programs to the provinces, which explains, I think, a lot of why we're sometimes in the trouble we are with our social problems here in Canada and Quebec. But, you know, more extreme examples, Canada is always fairly moderate in these matters, so more extreme examples of this reaction to the sort of fiscal crisis was seen in, you know, UK with Margaret Thatcher, in the US with Reagan, much more dramatic attack on social spending. Anyway, you know, I'm not quite sure this history is entirely accurate. I challenge much of it, but that's the sort of high-level belief system. But right now, government is back. And this is, you know, an opportunity. This economic recession has, you know, I don't know if everyone kind of quite realizes, I'm sure people here do, but out in the world, you know, it's actually seen a steeper rise in unemployment than we saw in the 30s. You know, this is a personal economic recession with people's homes, their incomes, their jobs, their investments, in a way perhaps that, you know, really haven't seen even in the 80s or even in the 90s. So when you're stuck in an economic recession, and again, you know, the economists here will, you know, have to just either pale into sort of a coma or, you know, just accept this is an idiot's guide. Basically, in an economic recession, consumers aren't going to spend their way out of it because they're worried about their jobs. If they haven't lost them already, they worry they might. Investors are, you know, unwilling to invest too much more when they're already unable to sell what they're producing really at the price they're currently able to. So we're basically stuck, and the government enters in then able to spend, print money, or borrow it more rapidly than anyone else. That's the sort of, I know it's a bit crude, but let's just take that as a sort of rough description of the situation. But one of the really interesting insights from Keynes' analysis is that he considers this to be useful even if you spend the money on useless tasks. So we shouldn't really just take solace in the current moment that because we're spending government money, it's going to be really fantastically useful socially, because really, you know, his argument was even if it was spent digging holes, I know, cheap visual to keep you awake, even if it was, what is that about? Anyway, if it was spent digging holes and filling them up again, it would be economically useful. You know, the digger would get paid, spend money at the grocer would get paid, spend it at the tailor, and so on. And it's a, you know, classically economic multiplier argument, prime the pump. But I guess my argument and our challenge is, you know, why spend the money on digging holes and filling them up, which I think some of our stimulus package could be accused of doing, if you could spend it on something socially useful. So that's what, you know, again, this is high level, you know, attempting to paint an overall picture of it. Obviously, I would argue that you should be spending on socially useful items. So we need to understand really what problem to tackle and what investment to make. Now, this may seem very small-minded when we think of the scale of the challenges on health inequality we face, but nevertheless, you know, this is the kind of public policy reality, I think. The first off, a problem really without a solution is not a problem that's likely to be tackled by policymakers. It's just a fact of life. It's something politicians will tell you that, you know, largely we need to live with. If you come up with really great 20-year plans, they'll tell you that their successor will thank you for it. And all in all, you know, it isn't always viable. So what we need to do is learn from what works. I probably should say I spent my life in government, which is why I'm allowed to make these cheap government jokes, right? If I was an academic, you wouldn't be allowed to make these. We'd be hurt anyway. But I've spent it inside the machine for a long time, so I sort of feel I can make these comments that might not otherwise be acceptable. So what do we think we know about what works? And this is going to be just very high level. Each one of these claims could be, you know, forensically challenged, I know, but I just thought I'd paint a broad picture. Well, I think we do know that actually tax and benefit systems in parts of Canada and Europe are mostly progressive. You know, they are mostly redistributive. I think they're constrained politically by acceptable levels of taxation and perhaps the affordability, consequently, of transfer payments and tax benefits. But yeah, we do actually have signs of success, and we certainly have them here in Canada. The levels of inequality in Canada of income, if you use the low-income cutoff measure, is far greater before tax and after tax and benefits. So, and just to give you a little bit of an example, and I know these are really unpopular because we always usually say in the social policy world that inequality is getting greater and, you know, we really need to take the crisis seriously. And of course, there is an argument that that's true. But on the other hand, there is also some progress. These charts show us that really between 93, which, you know, was the point before the recession, and 2003, these LICO rates, the rates that we tend to use for measures of poverty here in Canada, went down. The blue bar is the 1993 figures. The green one is the 2003. So really throughout that period, you saw a progressive increase, and probably one of the greatest ones in Quebec itself, which you know, I think we have we pay for it for sure, but it doesn't go without some merit, at least on income inequality. And one of the success stories in Canada, and there's other success stories in other countries, but we made a concerted effort to abolish poverty of senior families, and we've largely managed to do it. I don't think we take much credit because there's a lot of other households who we haven't cracked, and this graph, as you can see, shows that senior families, you know, are a fraction of are living on low income. It's less than 3.2% at this point. It's largely because of a means-tested benefit. Again, you know, I don't think we should make wild assumptions about always being the right instrument, policy terms. The guaranteed annual income supplement has basically, you know, lifted most elderly people, particularly two family households, out of poverty. And you can see, though, of course, that the next big challenge here is the female lone parent families, which, of course, I am one, so I'm looking forward to that social challenge, which hasn't yet been taken, as well as single households at all. So some people talk now about an intergenerational, from single young people under 25 to an older generation who are benefiting from our program. But the main thing in terms of my argument about what works is, you know, when we put our minds to it, actually we can make a difference. And sometimes it's a mixture of universal and means-targeted benefits, of which the old age security is one in Canada. But looking in the UK, and I know there's lots of UK people here, so I'm sure to be challenged by the more detailed analysis, but basically I do think there has been progress made in reducing child poverty in the UK. In 1999, the government committed itself to have child poverty by 2010 and eradicate it by 2020. I was in government at the time, you know, my whole life probably committed to having a government that would make such a commitment. But if you're on the inside of the government, it's a bit of a challenge, really. It's not that long. How are we going to do this, you know, in the real world? We don't have a dictatorship where we can just take people's money. So we will have to find some politically acceptable. So it's not easy, but basically, it's risen a little bit with the recent recession. But this is two charts that recently published that show, really, that there's a lot of progress. Between 1998-99 and 2005-06, over 600,000 children were lifted out of relative poverty. And that's tricky. That means as the boat's floating up, you've got to get the bottom to float and the gap to decrease. So it's quite a challenging measure. But even by that measure, you know, over 600,000 children were lifted out of poverty. And if you take a more normal one, which is lifting out of relative poverty, which is more like, you know, just lifting it up from the bottom, we had 1.8 million children out of absolute poverty. And this is, you know, largely been due to reforms to the tax and benefit system. I think there's been analysis done that if the government had done nothing more than just increase it by the cost of living, there would have been 1.7 million more children in poverty than there are today. So, you know, I think, again, if you set your mind to it, if you actually start using, in this case, not only the tax and benefit system, but actually the public service system. The public service system is a universal system that doesn't serve poor people very well. And if you start challenging it to target its services to serve poor people well, it starts looking quite different, not giving everybody the same, but giving poor people something quite different. And an example of a different type of program really was the Sure Start program in the UK, which again I think is a good example of a strategic investment. I think it has been shown to have very positive results by independent evaluations that have been done both by the National Evaluation for Sure Start. You can go on their website and examine their studies, which are published there. Ofsted, which is an independent inspectorate, has also published the results. Some of the characteristics of this, I think in contrast to the program we have here in Quebec, it's not just giving people a commodity called childcare and pricing it cheaply or not having it at any price at all, which is tentative in our strategy here in Quebec. But it's actually a partner. It's targeted towards those neighbourhoods where, you know, the under-5's performance would be the most deprived, if you like, and it's made it a partnership between parents and all service providers, not just early years providers, but schools, housing, landlords, the police, the social services, and these early years partnerships have really been charged first on a piloted basis in the most deprived communities, but rolled out over time. And I think the thing that makes this different really is that it's, you know, there's an assumption again that targeted programs are stigmatizing. I'll tell you, people who lived on the other side of the geographic areas that had the right to this service were not pointing their finger at the others saying, you know, that poor them. They were trying to get in to the program where it was being targeted. So I think targeting can sometimes create a sort of, you know, a bit of a something that people want to be part of. And the program is rolled out. It's harder to roll out given the cost, but it is doing so. So, you know, those are just some examples, you know, of the way we can use the systems that we have to make some improvements, and I think there is evidence. I could talk a lot about where there's much more to do, but I chose to capture the ground on which we have made some progress. So what would we do differently the next time round? If the next time round you can see the social spenders are thinking, you know, Keynes is back, you know, spending might be back. Could we use this opportunity to spend money well? So I think there's a couple of lessons. Again, these are just high-level kind of, maybe they'll wind you up, maybe they won't, kind of assertions. The first thing is that I think we must stop claiming that spending public money is all about promoting what should be equality or securing social rights. There's really very little evidence that this is the case. You know, we shouldn't really wear our high levels of tax and spending as a badge of our progressiveness. I don't think it's sufficient. I think we sometimes have tended to do that. And if you look here in Canada at healthcare spending, there's very little in the discourse in our country other than the fact that there's not enough money in the system. But when you look at our relative spending on healthcare in OECD terms, already amongst the highest spenders, this chart is very small, I know, but basically Canada is the fifth highest spender in this OECD chart. This it's really only ranked higher by the US, and we know that their spending pattern isn't always progressive either. But also by Norway, Switzerland, and Luxembourg. Many of the countries that we beg to envy, we love to look at with longing, like France, Sweden, Denmark, and others, actually spend less than us. You'd never know that from the common sense discourse. And actually, another common myth is that this is all, you know, if you listen to the American debate on healthcare, you'd think Canada was a sort of modern Albania in terms of social spending. But actually, I mean, this isn't a badge of courage, but we do have 30% of our spending here, and even in the Canadian healthcare system is private spending, which is the top part of that bar. So let's stop using spending as a quasi-indicator of progressiveness or equality. It really, it's an element, but it's not by itself sufficient. What else should we do differently? Well, I think if we are going to spend a lot of money, we should get way more equality for it. I don't think we get a whole lot of equality for the money we spend. I mean, I spent time at the Audit Commission, which looks at service delivery and health and local services across England and Wales, mainly for nationally funded, nationally specified services, and the variations between different parts of the country and between what individuals in different communities or even in the same community get is enormous. It's not sufficient to have national programs nationally funded. If we are going to spend money, let's look at how we get equality for it, and for that we're going to have to be much cleverer about it. Just to let you know, here in Montreal, we're not outside of the health inequality world. It's not anything like what Sir Michael's report shows on a global scale, but even here in the Onet of Montreal, what this map shows is that there's about a five-year health inequality difference between the life expectancy rates of people living in the longest living CLSE, which is our little service catchment area, and the least longest living CLSE. It's about a five-year difference. Not that much, but it's something. If you disaggregated it into ward level, smaller districts, you find it much bigger. And it's not quite as high for women. You'll notice this is also a language division, so this is endless fun for Montrealers. those are the inside discussion, because the west part of the island, which tends to be living longer, is where all those Anglos live, and the east part of the island is where all the Francophone and live. So as someone who's on the board of the health agency in Montreal, I can assure you this is not our policy that the west end of the city should live longer than the east end of the city. But there we are. It seems to happen. So, and again, one could say a whole lot more about why that is, but I can tell you the healthcare system is doing very little about it. It largely doesn't notice, except in the public health side, which, you know, isn't where all the money is, really. So let's get more equality if we're going to spend tons of money. And I think some of the devices are that might give us an opportunity to get more equality, if you like, for our money. One is that point's been made by many is that really this is too important a question to be left to government alone. You know, government can't make people healthy. It can't make people learn. We know this. So we should stop talking as if it can. Citizens are essential, whether you call them consumers or citizens. And, you know, you're going to need other sectors for sure. I mean, I do some of my research at the moment in Nunavik. And if you wanted an example, I'm going to annoy everyone here, but if you wanted an example of how not to produce health, social spending in a community, I think we've got a lot of examples there. We've replicated the Quebec health and social service system down to the last établissement, across the 14 communities of Nunavik. We've got a deficit-based approach where we look for health and social problems and we try and meet them with professionals, mainly from the south. We shouldn't be surprised, but we still continue on the same route, but we shouldn't be surprised that it's producing just no social gain at vast cost. You know, and there's lots of examples of that. That's one of the most obvious examples. So we should, I think, get more social justice and equality through allowing people more choice. I know, I think for many people, the idea of choice and equity is an antithesis, but I think they actually are quite compatible. I know I'm going to have run out of time, but I always think of the example of, I studied with Peter Townsend, who is, some of the people know, the UK's first writer of health inequalities. And he conceived the idea of relative poverty, I think many people would say, as a measure and as a concept. And he and I used to argue vigorously, he was my PhD supervisor, that his concept of the basket of indicators for relative deprivation was if you couldn't afford a roast on Sunday dinner. Well, at the time, being a student and young in those days, I was living in a vegan collective of socialist feminists, and they wouldn't have let a roast in the door. actually, we weren't allowed answering the door to men at the time. So it seemed to me that, if you were going to impose them into a category of relatively deprived people, there was something wrong with the measure. Now, maybe that's a silly anecdote, and it probably is, but there is an element of truth to it. We have a highly diverse world. I work with some of the greatest, as they like to call themselves, mouthy social workers that you can know. And the more vigorous their social advocacy, the less their willingness to be told what to do. And I think a lot of people are like that. So, let's think about people having some agency, as we say in more philosophical terms, and giving some more personalized delivery of what might be universal entitlements. I had some examples, but I'm not going to be able to give you them, about patient choice in the UK. A lot of British people here who will argue that it's not a good thing, I'm sure. But I think it has, if I had the time, I would argue that it has made some major changes in the array of healthcare. It's also lightened things up by some of the, little ads that have been given about, hospitals that look a little bit more like what you might see choosing a new flat than a surgery. Also, a little bit of humour in the British public service. Some of these designs were obviously look like your holiday brochure. So at the top, there's the kind of facilities the hospital might have, and down the left side, the hospital itself. It's like does it have a pool? It was an attempt to make it popular, and I think if we want public services to be loved and supported, I think we should make a little effort in that direction. This is a similar one, only more of an evaluative. Previous chart was just about what it has, facilities. This is more like a performance. The blue one is the performance information about how well it's doing, if it's achieving its target. Blue, it is. Red, yellow, it isn't. And the patient's views also get, so there's not just the objective truth, if you like, there's what patients themselves said. Anyway, this kind of information in the future, I think we should be doing more of if we want people to get involved. I'm not going to have time to really do any more on this, but I really am a big fan of Robert Frank, who argues that we should tax things that we want more of. We shouldn't tax things we want more of. We should tax things we want less of. I think there's some insights there that we should think about, and we talked a little bit about them, I think, in our workshops yesterday. I'm also think there's quite a lot of scope around some of the thinking around the architecture, the science of choice, and the sort of architecture of choice that people who've following this idea of the nudge principles have written. And there are a lot of examples, I think quite compelling ones, of how we can get people to do the right thing by nudging them rather than bribing them, another word for incentive, or telling them what to do. And I think that, this is an interesting range for the future. And I also think that if we want a pro-social society, you know, really at a collective level, some of the work being done in neuroscience and behavioral sciences around the social brain is really quite interesting. And I know Laurette's got many endeavors in this area. I don't have time to talk about them. But basically, this shows, you know, there is an interaction between the social world and the brain's chemistry. You know, why do we always see a door that says push and we pull it? Well, there's reasons for this. The neuroscientists can tell us. You know, there are things prompting us to act and behave in certain ways that are not in our best interests. That's the way we are as real human beings and not the way we should be, fully informed, making rational choices. Anyway, these, I think, provide areas in the modern world for future social policies that might be affordable, that might actually tap into people's personal sense of rights and entitlements that might also be politically winnable. That's it. Thank you. I'm 4 minutes over. Very sorry. All right.
Thank you very much, Wendy.